Welcome to Getting Real Estate with Josh and Casey.
Josh Lenhart from Director's Mortgage.
And I'm Casey Spohr with John L. Scott.
What is your death with dignity benchmark? My wife has been clear with me that like anytime after 60, it's like if I have a real bad cold.
Just call it, get me out of here.
My mother-in-law says if she were to get like dementia or whatever, she's like, I don't care. She's like, I'm out. She's like, don't put me in a nursing home. Don't like go out of your way to take care of me. Like, I'm done.
Yeah, Megan's family, like we've seen it firsthand. It's pretty rough. Like half of her family is like mental deterioration and half is physical deterioration. Oh. So like seeing, she's like, I don't know what's going to happen to me.
Yeah.
Seriously, though.
I'm going to live for a really long time.
My doctor friends have said that sauna actually has like been demonstrated now pretty clearly to have prohibitive.
It's so good.
I got an ice bath and my next step is getting an in-home sauna because I know like the health
benefits.
It's astronomical sauna benefits going like back and forth between them. It's like 30% reduced chance of like every type of disease, cancer. It's like wild numbers. It's not like, oh, like 1%. It's like crazy amounts. So
We'll probably have to have you scoot a little bit closer, but okay, let's get into this. So
welcome
back, everybody.
Holy smokes,
it's just been like a hot second.
Just a month or two.
We still just have like our last podcast episode that I still need to edit.
It's no big deal.
Yeah,
it's life gets busy sometimes.
Life gets busy. It's been it was a busy summer. It's been a busy fall. I think it's going to be a busy winter. But,
I think so, too.
But here we are.
Yeah, here we are back with a wonderful, spectacular guest today.
I'm so excited about our guest, Matt Springer with Friends of the Children. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Glorious.
Let's have you just quickly like introduce yourself, tell us who you are, what you do, how you got into it. Maybe like your social security number, credit card numbers, all of that. The important things we need to know.
The nonprofit sector is great, but I think in terms of like financial benefit for anyone getting into my bank account.
Okay, we might need
to. It's like those things that are like, take my credit card, you can pay my debts for me or whatever. Yeah.
Maybe we'll invite somebody else and try that next
time. Well, my name is Matt Springer. As said, I came out to Eugene originally in 1998 to work for Northwest Youth Corps. Great organization, loved it.
Where'd you come from?
Sort of a circuitous path. I was a Navy brat, and so we lived in London when I was in eighth grade through high school.
Very cool.
So I lost residency everywhere, and fortunately, my parents were like, "We'll help you with school, like wherever you go." So I was in Colorado, felt like I wanted to work with what was termed at the time at-risk kids, and wanted to work in the mountains, which is strange because I had only ever lived in big cities. But c'est la vie. I came out and it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you mean, like, it was termed at-risk kids?
It, typically, folks, like, tend to want to come at things from a positive growth mindset sort of place at this point. So, say, you know, people that are experiencing challenges or things like that, rather than focusing on what might be deemed as...
the risk-based aspect of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of more negative.
Yeah. So what is like the new term? Like, what is the new term for that? Is there a specific one?
I think that's a fair question. It's a pretty dynamic environment,
yeah.
I think, across sort of like all lenses of equity. And but I think really trying to center the humanness of people. And
yeah.
So where we say, you know, people that may be experiencing homelessness or kids that may be experiencing challenges.
Yeah.
Really just trying to focus on the human aspect of it.
Yeah.
Which is like really the case. That's the reality, right? It's not at risk. It's that they are people dealing with challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that case, it might be a child that's more susceptible, you know, just to certain ills or risks.
Yep.
You know, based upon their experiences.
Yeah.
And where are you at now? So who are you with? What do you do?
So now I work with Friends of the Children. It's an organization we started 4 years ago. We're independent, locally governed, but we have the benefit of joining a national network of chapters that run the same sort of model that we run. And what we do at Friends of the Children is we try to identify families that are really facing significant challenges.
Okay.
Things like incarcerated parents or involvement with foster care or mental health or, you know, addiction issues. And the more layers there are, the more likely it is we'll offer partnership to families. And basically what we offer is two sets of services. One is a professional mentor that will begin working with a child between the ages of 4 and 6. And we commit to that family for 12 years. So that child would have a professional mentor for that 12 years.
Until they graduated high school.
Yeah, basically their whole childhood. And then for the parents or caregivers, or what we call the kids people, we offer them wraparound services. So it's really trying to work with them to say, what are the issues you're facing? What are the things that might destabilize your home environment? Let's get you connected to other services before those things become crises.
Yeah.
What kinds of things are you managing most frequently, or what are examples of those things for families?
Won't be surprising in this community, but about 55% of those families that we work with, or the families that we work with, are housing insecure. Meaning month to month, they don't know where they're going to be. So that's probably the biggest issue by far. I'd say basic needs and food insecurity are also big. But in the families that we're working with, sort of as you begin to aggregate those challenges, it becomes more likely that you will also encounter other challenges. So, you know, the duress of mental health, you know, becomes an issue. And sometimes those things will rise up. Sometimes addiction will be the thing that rises up. And there are sort of those, cyclical challenges will re-rise.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about our work is that we're there regardless. And so
yeah.
as those issues come up, we're able to help address them. And it's one of the ways that we're a little bit different than most nonprofits or social services that tend to address one of those issues for a shorter period of time. We're just sort of like, let's jump in the deep end with you. We're in here for 12 years. Let's all figure it out together.
Yeah.
Regardless of what
And that's
out.
That's one of the huge things. Well, there's multiple things that I love about your organization is when you came to my office, how I met Matt is he came to our office and you talked to us about it. And I was like, okay, well, I need to do whatever I can to like assist this organization. Is I love that your mentors are paid staff. It's easy. I mean, there's a lot of successful programs that have volunteers, which is amazing. But one of the things that you said is we understand that sometimes short-term intervention could be more harmful than no intervention at all, which I think is a major thing that we see in our foster care system is kids bounce in and out of these foster homes, and they'll go into a foster home, back with their parents, into a foster home, back with their parents, or like foster home to foster home to foster home. And it's that short-term intervention, like it would almost like...
The more it happens, the less desired they feel, because it's like, I don't fit in anywhere.
They don't have anything consistent. And I love that you have requirements for your mentors, like one, they're paid employees, and then isn't it, you said that they have to commit to 3 years at least.
So, volunteer-based mentoring is awesome.
And amazing.
Really
yeah.
consistently positive impacts, and it tends to be small, right?
Yeah.
And so Big Brothers Big Sisters program is really phenomenal in being able to reach many families. But when we start to look at these families that are really facing very large challenges in their life, the chances of being able to effectively serve that child and that family through a volunteer-based service, it becomes less likely. And and just because those volunteers won't necessarily have the skill base or background to be able to deal with really challenging issues, and they tend to be short-term, as you said. So we know in relationship-based mentoring, where the relationship is really the key point of focus, that we can do damage if it's short-term. And as you pointed out, well, it will trigger those abandonment issues, will re-traumatize that child in many circumstances. DHS has it rough in child welfare, has it rough
so
foster
much.
Care system, just spread very thin, and a lot of people doing phenomenal work in that space. And particularly in our area, we just don't have enough people serving in that space. And so kids are getting bounced around, and unfortunately, we do see the impacts of that for those kids. And it really is the population of kids that I think are most comparable to the kids that we serve.
Yeah.
And the outcomes that we sort of gauge our impacts against often.
Yeah. What are the kind of services that you're offering? Like, let's say for somebody with housing challenges, is it like looking at low income options? Is it stabilizing employment? Is it trying to do grant, like monthly stipend type things? Like, what are you doing to help offer support in those ways?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and I'm not sure there's a simple answer to that. One of the values that we have is empowerment, and so we're trying to work with families to teach and learn how to navigate systems alongside them, more than provide direct financial support for those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
So occasionally we're able to get grants. We have a great grant right now through Trillium that helps us provide some rental assistance and things like that. So that's rare, but in some cases we can provide that direct financial support. More often, we're working with all of the other agencies that are providing housing support in our community, St. Vinny's and Catholic Community Services and housing, you know, all the agencies we have that are doing great work in that space, and trying to find like the one or two houses that may be coming on the market that would be available for families like ours.
Right.
It's real challenging.
Yeah. The other thing that I love about you guys is you don't look at it as just like, oh, there's all these like issues, but you look at the fact of like this, the things that these kids are experiencing, if it's kids with behavioral issues, mental health issues, stuff like that, it's a generational thing. It typically comes from generational trauma. Maybe the parents of parent, like it's a generational thing, and you guys are trying to intervene and kind of like be a positive influence on these kids, kind of give them structure to hopefully help, like you had said, bring them out of that fight or flight so their brain can kind of heal itself and maybe like change. So maybe if like their parents have depression, severe anxiety, that's kind of put them in this situation where they can't maybe hold a job or keep a house or whatever, then you are kind of coming in to intervene with these kids, give them a safe space, but then also aid their parent, but then take that kid out of fight or flight. So if they are predisposed to mental health issues, you guys are kind of helping try to like rewire their brain, because really that's what's going to help stop the generational trauma of things.
Yeah. It's awesome. Yeah. I mean, just to hit that, our overall goal really is to break the cycles of disadvantage. And so we look at it as this long-term consistent intervention that is resource intensive. I mean, we're putting a lot of time and effort into these families and into an individual child. And the reason to do that is so that all the generations moving forward aren't dealing with the same sort of challenges that the family is right now. And the reason those cycles are so prevalent, and I love the brain science, and stop me if this gets too dorky. But
it's not too dorky. I love it. Bring it on.
So when we think about folks that have experienced trauma, and particularly young kids, right, there is what's called ACEs, right, or adverse childhood experiences, sort of a specific set of things that are really impactful on the development of a child and their brain, right? And so when there are those traumatic experiences, and particularly if there's many of them, and four or more is really the breaking point. Those traumatic experiences become the best predictor of bad health outcomes, right? And things like depression, suicidal ideation, those types of things that you might anticipate out of negative experiences, but also things like cancers, lung cancers, heart disease, all of those things. Trauma becomes the best predictor of those long-term bad health outcomes.
Huge physical ailments given the mental... Yeah.
And the reason for that we come to understand is toxic stress. And so basically the body is only accessing the amygdala, right? Your hormones are flushing, your heart rate is up, your breathing is accelerated. And for kids that have experienced that, they're living most of their life in that state. The other thing we know about that is that you're not able to access the more critical or executive functions of your brain as well when you're in that state. And so folks, functional IQ drops, 40 to 60 points. And things like emotional regulation, problem solving, et cetera, are things that people can't access when they're in that state.
Yeah.
And so we put kids into a classroom. They can't think well. They can't problem solve well. They're not able to regulate themselves because they're in this space. And when they're living in that state most of the time, and they have this toxic stress that they're just living in, that's when we start to see those chronic issues develop. The other issue is that how can we expect kids to be successful in those traditional settings?
Yeah.
When that's their lived experience.
Yeah.
You know, when they're experiencing the world as a dangerous pace and people as a dangerous circumstance, how can we expect them to be successful?
Right.
Some of the cool things we really see is when we're able to help kids regulate, so to get out of that space, right? Like, let's take time to identify color, or let's breathe together, right?
Yeah.
And we get them out of that state, and they're able to then reaccess their executive functions. They can think critically. They can begin to regulate themselves. Is we see these really dramatic growth opportunities in literacy and in school success, where we're not helping them learn math. It's just that they're able to access the parts of their brain that do math.
Yeah.
And suddenly, oh, they're doing far better, right?
You're like, oh, you're actually like great at math and you never had the chance to know that you were great at math.
You're actually great at math?
Yeah. Yeah.
Literacy, so we've been able to track, and this is pretty neat. We've seen it go both ways. So one girl that we were working with came in, she couldn't recognize all her letters at the time we started working with her, which was a pretty good indication that not where she should have been in terms of literacy achievement. 3 months later, she was in the 67th percentile in the nation. Wow. in literacy.
In the nation. Wow. That's incredible.
And just in terms of the assessment that's used, so that's about 5 million kids. You know? Yeah. But mm-hmm. she's in those upper tiers. That has nothing to do with letter capacity or it's little to do with that. It just has to do with making that brain,
feel safe.
Open up to itself, feel safe, get in that space. Be in a classroom where suddenly it's about learning, not about how do I protect myself.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we've also seen the opposite. When we have families that become homeless or there is a re-traumatization, using that same literacy assessment, we've seen kids, like, we had a kid somewhere in the 80th percentile drop down to, the 25th, right? Okay. And again, it's not that they suddenly can't comprehend the written word or understand what's happening in a book. It's that their body is working on other stuff.
Yeah.
And prioritizing that. So I've come to think about what we do as really teaching kids to regulate, helping them co-regulate with other people. That relationship is really a key to that.
Yeah.
If folks could regulate on their own, they would be, right? And so having a trusted relationship that allows them to get into that space over and over again, right, begins to build those neural pathways in a different way, right? And so we think about neural pathways as a pathway or a highway. The more often you travel them, the better the more likely it is the brain's going to travel that way again.
Yeah, right? For sure.
And so what we have is a base case where trauma, fear, that fight or flight is running the ship. Those are the highways, mm-hmm. And then we slowly start to get kids comfortable with other paths, right? Like maybe people are safe. Maybe you can do this thing. Maybe you can take a risk on a friendship. Maybe you can take a risk on an adult you don't know in a certain circumstance, right? And the more we're able to sort of microdose those challenges, the more a kid is likely to walk that path again.
Right.
And slowly over time, we build that out into a road, highway, etc. And you have a much more healthy, functional way that their brain is operating.
Yeah.
How many volunteers are currently in our area do you work with? And then is it one-on-one with the families or is one volunteer helping multiple? What is the scope of?
So their mentors are actually hired staff. So.
Sorry, the mentors. But is it one mentor for one family or is it mentor is hired on for multiple or how does it work?
It's really common. And this is sort of the default because when we think about mentoring, right, Big Brothers Big Sisters has done such a phenomenal job of sort of branding around mentorship that's what we all revert to.
Yeah.
And so what we do, as Casey was saying, is we ask folks to commit for 3 years. That helps us get over that hump of potential harm with families. And in response, we say, all right, we'll give you benefits. We'll pay you well out of the gate. You're going to commit to us and these families. We're going to commit to you. We were just nominated one of the 15 best nonprofits in Oregon.
I would like rate you number one.
Yeah, so but that's incredible. What does committing mean? Like when somebody says I'm committed to be a mentor, what does that mean for them and what does that mean for the family?
Professionally and legally, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, we can't hold somebody in this job. But we ask them to make that commitment. We explain to them why, right? That it's not so much about our retention, but it's about the best benefit for this kid and their family. And so, typically we're still seeing about 2.5 years, folks are getting burnt out from those jobs. I mean, they're hard jobs.
It's a hard job.
Secondary trauma in there. And so at that point, we begin intentionally transitioning them. And that might be to other kids. It might be, into another position with us or might be out of the organization. And we're in that space right now. We have 5 new mentors coming in.
And what do they do, for that time? What are their services to that family?
Yeah, awesome. So our professional mentors serve each kid that they have. They have a roster of 8 kids, 3 to 4 hours each week. And half of that time is in school, and half of it is out in the community doing community-based activities. A lot of what we do, particularly with the younger kids, is literacy-oriented. And so we call it camouflage mentoring. We might be asking them to read a road sign or, sort of trick them into, let's figure out how these phenomes work and those types of things. Literacy is a big point. And then mental health is probably the other major piece. And so last year we did, 8,832 mental health interventions. And those are things like anger management or naming and labeling feelings, things that we know that we can provide that have a therapeutic benefit. And through that process, we're just trying to build their mental health resiliency over time. A lot of it is really just that regulation piece.
Yeah.
Let's get you back to a safe space.
So one mentor, 8 kids is what they're assigned, you said?
One mentor, yeah. 8 kids. And so their day is split. Like, they'll go see a couple kids in the morning in schools. We're there at the... in whatever way a teacher can best utilize those professional mentors. So it could be that they're sitting in class with them and just helping them with assignments. It could be that they're taking them out into the hallway and doing stuff on their own. It could be during recess when there tends to be issues.
This is outside of the school resources as these people are operating and working within the schools or helping, like, you know.
Yeah.
And what schools have you guys partnered with? I know you said Springfield Schools last time we talked about it. Have you gotten into more, like, what schools? Have you gotten into more schools? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So let me come back around to that.
Yeah, for sure.
I think one of the key things that I've learned is that, you know, we put so much pressure on schools to be all the things for all the kids.
Right.
And we have kids in the circumstance that have particularly high needs around time and attention to help them be successful in that traditional environment. And we're asking teachers who are also serving 32 other kids to serve that one kid that really needs this, you know. And I just think it's an unfair request. And so often our districts and our schools are trying to resolve that circumstance, trying to help these kids as best they can. They're just stretched too thin. And I wish we were all sort of more open to a collaborative approach, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're going to try to help all these kids be successful in schools and not just rely on the schools to do it. And so let's bring in external partners. Let's bring in 15th Night. Let's bring in Friends of the Children to help be a resource in the schools and not just expect the institutions to do it themselves. Right now we're working with 22 schools, I think, in six districts.
Wow.
But predominantly we're in Bethel, 4J, Springfield, and Cottage Grove. As we sort of worked with those schools to select children initially in our area in order to find low-income housing, though folks are really, really transient in terms of trying to identify where they can find homes. So
we have
2 families out in Oak Ridge right now. We have 1 in Junction City. We have 1 in Benton County. We've had kids in Florence, in Veneta, 21 miles outside of Cottage Grove, near Dorena Lake. The map is crazy. The miles we put in is pretty crazy. Pacific Source allowed us to get some electric cars, which has helped with the cost
that's
of
awesome.
That.
Good.
Yeah. They're actually these really cool electric Mustangs.
Oh, very cool. Oh, my husband test drove those. He went with a Tesla.
Fancy.
Stupid robot car. That's what I call it.
It does feel fancy, which honestly is kind of cool. Like, both our headquarters location and the vehicles we use, like, I view as part of our therapeutic milieu. You know, like, where we have a really light space and it's fun and kids can come in and they feel some ownership in there and it's for them. And that might be an asset they don't have anywhere else in their life. And I feel the same about our cars. Like, I'm really excited they get to get in these cool looking electric Mustangs. And
as a kid that grew up poor, to have, like, if I would have been in that situation to, like, have a mentor that I got to, like, get picked up from school and like that. Yeah.
In your cool car.
Yeah. I would imagine that would be very therapeutic for them. Like, very cool for them.
We don't have any kids in middle school yet, and I think it might change.
You know,
when they get there, where they're like, absolutely not. But the word from our Portland chapter has been around for 30 years, and they serve 400 families at this point. And they're like, by the time they get to high school, they want to hang out with mentors again. It's fine.
But that middle school is a bit tumultuous.
Middle school, they get more excited about group outings. So, like, can we get a couple other kids?
Yeah.
And we're walking out together.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's how we'll roll.
When
the time comes.
Yeah, interjecting with them in that way, being a part. I don't now remember. I volunteered a while back with an institution that, like, they realized that they had done some research about people that, like, theirs is more folks that had gone to prison and then were coming and trying to get reinstated back into society.
Yeah.
It was like they could find them a job, they could find them a house, they could find them, but there was, like, 8 pieces to this pie.
Yeah.
And they're like, the one that was missing and the one that was the most prevalent on, like, repeat offenders or things like going back into was lack of connection with people. So the whole program was designed where you then became, like, connected one-on-one with a person where they could then. And just speaking of, like, you were mentioning earlier about the trials, tribulations, challenges that they're facing, you know, what they're dealing with in their home life. When I was going through the program, I had dealt with somebody who had done some relatively violent things. But when I became friends with this person and would talk to him about his life, the circumstances that were surrounding what was happening, it was very, I mean, like, I am a straight-laced mortgage loan officer with a family, like, you know, all this picture. And it just very quickly dawned on me. I'm like, I am 2 decisions away from being exactly where you are. And the choices that you made
are not unlike the ones that I feel like I would make. You know, it's like a circumstance, like hit, they were in a hard crowd and he came to his brother being assaulted and he reacted violently to that person who had horrifically hurt his little brother. And thinking, I'm like, well, yeah, if I walked in on somebody doing something to my family, my reaction would likely be similar. Like, we are not too dissimilar just because my environment was easier to avoid some of those things doesn't mean that, like, us as humans are really, you just, there's a separation, I feel like, mentally from people like, I could never, I would never. And I'm like, you absolutely would. The worlds that you live in are different, but, like, we as people are not all that different. And the choices that they're making and the places that they end up and the hurdles that they're jumping through, you do not realize how close we all are to, like, traversing the same life together. Mm-hmm. It was just very eye-opening to me being like, oh, we're not that different. The separation is not wildly, you know, there's not a chasm between who I am and who this other person is. I'm like, we're essentially the same.
Yeah.
Walking this life together.
Oh, I love that. That was beautifully succinct description of empathy. And one of the things that we run into a lot is when we talk about kids and what we do, folks are like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, you're in it for mm-hmm. the long term. That's so glorious. And then we'll be like, we support the adults as well. And they're like, why are you supporting them? Like, these are people that have made bad decisions or are using their money, you know, in ways that aren't wise. And the way we view it is, this is simply that kid, you know, 18 years later or 20 mm-hmm. years later that hasn't gotten any more support. And so still is in that dysregulated place of yeah. fight or flight where life is fearful and our systems haven't necessarily provided those folks the opportunities that it's provided the rest of us.
You don't just turn 18 and you're like, well, now, since I can make the decisions, now I have all of the tools to be able to make those right decisions. It's like, well, eventually they have to be accountable to their actions. It's like, they were never taught
yeah.
that definition. They don't know what that leap is.
Their brains never got out of that fight or flight mode, so they can only make
decisions.
The poor choices and the poor decisions.
Or are making those decisions out of a brain that is still not utilizing its full capacity, mm-hmm. right? Or hasn't literally grown to its full capacity
yeah.
yet.
Yeah.
You know, like, so we know that the cerebral cortex continues to grow, right?
Yeah.
And they talk about neuroplasticity, right? It's never too late for your brain to change. We don't become solid. When folks get in prison, their hypothalamus shrinks, right? Like, you become mm-hmm. less capable because you've been isolated from other people, right? We are tribal beings, you know, and we're
yeah.
meant to be with other people, and we're in our healthiest when we are. And so when we lose those connections, we all saw this during COVID, right? Like, when you lose those connections, you become less resilient. You become less healthy.
Depression, all those things increase wildly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those are circumstances with, you know, somebody who has like a relatively healthier brain, like, find themselves spiraling. I'm like, okay, now take that and make every other life circumstance. Like, you don't have any of the other advantages that you hold dear. About your ability to hold a job, the house that you have, the food that you can eat, the nutrition that you put into your body, the vitamins that you can take, the exercise that you can have, like, all of these things that you are like, well, why don't they just do that? It's like, they don't have that. They don't have the resources, tools, abilities, what, not just physically, but like mentally and emotionally. Those tools were never developed.
Yeah. I think our, you know, folks will sometimes view families in poverty, folks in poverty, as making poor decisions. And I think the reality is, given the same opportunities, our families would very likely make the same decisions that many of us would make, and are all looking for their families to be healthy and their children to be healthy and well tended to. But transportation gets in the way. You know, it's very expensive to be poor, right? Like, where
yes.
you can't store things.
Yeah.
Where you can't buy in bulk, you know, where you can't get an electric vehicle to help offset fuel costs, you know, where you're sort of living in a very reactionary place. As you said, when you're doing that, there's more opportunity for hardship to enter your life.
Yep.
The other challenge that we know about the brain is that, folks, there's a good quote that's like, I'd rather live with certain misery than the, oh, I'm going to forget, I'm going to mess this quote up. But essentially, like, because we are all accustomed to things that we are familiar with, you're more likely to enter dramatic relationships if dramatic relationships are ones that you know. Right?
Yep.
You're more
yeah.
likely to make sabotage relationships that may be good if you've only ever experienced bad relationships, you know, or unhealthy relationships,
right.
just because we're more likely to be attracted into those situations because we're familiar with them, even if they do us harm. And it's one of the really unfortunate realities of trauma is trauma tends to attract more trauma.
Yeah.
And so part of what we do is we try to, you know, partner with those families and say, we recognize this trauma has occurred. Let's try to prevent further trauma from happening, and let's begin that process of healing from the existing trauma. And as new trauma arrives, as it is likely to, you know, let's address it. We'll try to address it in the best and most, you know, beneficial way we can. And in doing that, hopefully we're avoiding those long-term hardships, right? We're avoiding those literal cancers. We're avoiding, I think, life dependency, life expectancy, excuse me, life expectancy for folks that are living in poverty and have had some of these adverse experiences is 20 years less than for the rest of us, right? And so it's sort of like, can we intervene and make sure that the things that are impacting that are reduced enough that, you know, that we're living comparable lifestyles? I mean, like, literally, right. The longevity that you'll, you know, the number of years you'll be here will be comparable.
Well, I know that, obviously, we have talked, and I'm always like, what do you guys need? And I know that the biggest thing is just to let people know that you're here, and awareness of your organization is huge. So Friends of the Children is in Eugene, doing incredible, incredible things for our youth and our families. We talked about a thing. Are you ready to announce that or not quite yet?
No, I mean, it's funny because we started in July of 2020, you know, like 3 months into COVID, and made a very conscious decision of like, let's just get as much programming on the ground as we can, because families are frankly being decimated by this, by the situation. And we knew we were giving up awareness. Like, we knew we were like, we probably won't be able to, you know, talk about ourselves very well for everyone. And we've certainly not found our way to do that well yet. So we're still introduced very much in the space of introducing ourselves to the community, and think we're doing great work. We'd love to extend, you know, our support services to many families as possible. We've been growing at about 16 families per year.
That's awesome.
At this point.
And
the only thing that will stop us from reaching more folks is the ability to, you know, gain community support. We're also actively seeking public dollars and getting support through the avenues that are already available there as well. But really more support of the organization will just mean more support for families out there.
Yeah.
So one of the things we're starting this year is called the 12 by 12 by 12 campaign. And so since we commit to families for 12 years, we're inviting folks to get on board with $12 per month for 12 years, or I think it's like $1,700 overall. But just to make that long-term commitment to families that may not have as much privilege as we do, and bring greater equity to the community. Yeah. So that campaign's up on our website right now if folks want to go there or think about that.
What's your website? Do you want to give your website?
Yeah. It's friendslanecountyor.org.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's maybe a little bit too long, but.
Friends with an S?
Friends with an S.
Okay.
Friends with a Z?
You know, maybe.
Maybe in 2000.
We need to make
you need to be more
generation.
Hip with that.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was an absolute pleasure having you here. I'm excited for whatever you need my help with. I'm so glad that you could come on here and talk about your organization. And
Casey, if I can just interrupt with that, you're so great all the time. You guys need turkeys? You need pillows?
Please take my things.
Yeah. No, sometimes
all this stuff.
We have folks that will give us money, but it's it can make a huge difference to have folks like Casey involved. We had a family that you know, is really trying their best, and they have some medical vulnerabilities. They live in a very very tight spot financially. And had their fridge go out, and it was, you know, it's a tiny little fridge. They're feeding a family of five, and food started to spoil, and, you know, it had all sorts of ramifications in terms of mold in the house and things of that nature. But also weren't able to, you know, just store that food, and so complications around that. And it's so wonderful to be able to call somebody and be like, hey, any chance, you know, we can make a fridge happen?
If I can get you people, if I can get you a thing, I'll get it.
Yeah. But that made such a huge difference. And even the downstream effects of that, where that family trusting us a little bit more to say, actually, we also have these needs, and those needs being very genuine in terms of things that were impacting their family really badly in terms of their home environment, and finding out, oh, they might also need some plumbing help. You know, right now water's just running out under their home from their kitchen sink, right? That can't be good. Who knows what that looks like? Let's go look under the house. But it took a fridge to gain the trust to be able to go down there and check that out. And, you know, keeping that family whole in a house, in a place of trust, being in relationship with them is going to help, you know, their three children thrive. It's going to help keep the adults in that home in a happier, healthier place. And so I think that's the benefit of long-term relationship. It's not just we're helping you store your food. It's that we've helped create the sense that the community cares about you and we got you. You know? That Eugene is a place that, regardless of your circumstance, people are going to care about you. And that's really what we hope to extend to this community is the opportunity to be involved in that. Like, if you want to care about people, if you want to care about families and children that are facing hardship, cool. Like, get on board. $12 a month, you can be a part of that. We'll try to tell you as many stories as we can to make you feel good about what you're doing here. And in the process, you know, we're gonna make it a more equitable place and be able to end poverty for, you know, families moving forward.
So. Yeah. I think it's incredible. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you again. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time, maybe next month.
Hopefully
maybe,
next month.
Maybe not next month.
We'll do our best.
Yeah, we'll do it. We're just doing our best, okay? Yeah. All right. We'll see you next time.